A great song from Steve Bell, Fresh and Green. Before that, Annie Herring with Glory, Glory, Glory. And it's about 11 minutes after the hour. It is a Wednesday morning, and Doug Greenwald joins us. Doug is the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director of Preserving Bible Times. And we find Doug, we searched all over the country, found him in Dallas. He's hanging out in Dallas today. Doug, good morning to you. Welcome.
Morning, guys. What's the snow report?
Oh, it's there. It's snowing. 7 to 8 inches expected today. I'm just so delighted.
I was walking around on bare ground yesterday.
Yeah, yeah.
I even blew leaves.
I was in Wichita last week, and it got up to 86.
Oh.
And the day we left town, Sunday, it dropped down to 43.
Oh, that's more like it then. It's, nobody should see 86 degrees in the springtime. How are things in Dallas today?
Well, they're starting to warm up, but that same cold front that I think has affected you guys has gotten all the way down here. We were low 60s tomorrow. We're climbing towards low 70s this weekend.
Okay. So you're on the road. You're traveling. What you in Dallas for, if I may ask?
Well, I taught Monday night at a church in Highland Park, actually one of their fellowship groups in Highland Park, Texas. Thursday evening, I'm teaching for 2 hours on Maundy Thursday on the Passion of Jesus at the Frisco Bible Church. And the following evening, Good Friday evening, I'll be leading the worship service there at Frisco Bible. So what did I teach? 7 times last week in Kansas and 3 times this week in Texas.
You ever get confused as to where you are?
No. The only thing I get that helps simplify my life is we stay at Marriott's, and they always have the same breakfast. So, you know, there's just no decision to make when you're in a Fairfield Inn or a Courtyard or a Town Hills Suites Hotel. The breakfasts are all the same. It just simplifies life.
Yeah, Doug putting on a lot of miles, though, and Preserving Bible Times is that kind of ministry. And Doug travels constantly throughout the year. And not only does he do seminars at churches all around the country, but you go to places like Italy and Israel, too, don't you? You got a tour coming up.
Oh, we teach Context on Site. We really get excited about that. Early May, we're on a 10-day trip to southern Italy from Rome, working our way south to Sorrento, and then back up 23 stops where we're going to teach on the Roman world of Paul, and technically it's called Paul's response to the Roman world. Once we understand what's going on in Rome in the first century, and they uniformly export their culture all throughout the empire, we have a much better insight and understanding of why Paul wrote what he wrote and said what he said in his letters and epistles.
Now, this is the first time you've done a Pauline tour, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the missing piece. You know, there's the Holy Land experience in Israel, and then there's Paul's journeys where you get on a bus and drive for hours in Turkey, Asia Minor. But no one's really thought about going to Rome itself and reconstructing the Roman world of Paul's day that's operating all throughout the empire and how it impacts people and creates issues for the gospel. And so we call it the missing piece of biblical context, and we're really kind of excited about this whole new appreciation of biblical context and new expansion, really, of biblical context.
Well, Doug, you've been filling in missing pieces for us the past couple of weeks here with regard to Passion Week in first century Israel and the events. We started talking about Lazarus and being raised on the fourth day. We talked about Palm Sunday and this dramatic, tumultuous entrance into Jerusalem by Jesus on the donkey. We've talked about some of the teaching times that have gone on. What's on tap today? Because we're getting close to the big day here.
Yeah, I think we're going to stay within the last 48 hours here today. And I think the place I want to drop in first here is in John 14. It's the upper room discourse. And verses 2 and 3, I think, can really add to our appreciation of communion or the Eucharist. So let me read those two verses here. Jesus says, just before he starts to talk about what we call the Last Supper and his wine and his shed blood and so forth, "In my Father's house are many dwelling places." Different Bibles could read, "In my Father's mansions are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you, for I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. And what's striking about that is wedding talk. That is first century wedding talk. And this is the upper room discourse. And Jesus is talking about a future wedding. And weddings are great times of celebration and joy. And so he's about to bring a very somber motif about his blood being shed. But before he does that, he creates this celebratory joy here of the wedding motif. And the picture here, try to sketch it with words on radio here, is most people, like 90% of them, live in small one-room homes in Israel. But there are a few wealthy people, and they live in what are known as insula homes, I-N-S-A-L-U-E, or U-L-A-E, excuse me. And that means multi-room homes. And basically, you know, grandpa probably started to build a wall in a town, his compound, if you will, that might be 70, 80 feet on a side, big square. And it's got a couple of doorways into it that get into the courtyard. And he, in one corner of that square, builds a one-room home, probably 6-7 foot wide and 15 foot deep. And that's where he lives. And then let's say that he and his wife, Miriam, have 5 sons. Well, by the time the first son gets old enough to get married, let's say he's 18, 19, and he's betrothed, when the betrothal contract is written by a scribe in this culture and the dowry is all arranged, he will then leave his bride-to-be and go back and build a second room right next to mom and dad's room in that corner of this big 80-foot square. And when that room is done, which is going to be his home, he will then send a messenger to his bride-to-be saying he's coming shortly. And then he will come and fetch his bride and have a multi-day wedding feast. And then he will take that bride to his new one-room home in the family compound and consummate their marriage. And the same thing is going to happen for sons 2, 3, 4, and 5. So by the time we get through the first generation here, we've got 6 rooms on one side of the square. And then they have sons, and they repeat this process. And so you keep adding rooms as you go around the boundary condition of this 80-foot square high wall. That's your piece of property. And there are archaeological evidences of some 150 people living in these multi-room family compounds, you know, sort of like Hyannisport for the Kennedys.
And this would have been all about sons because, of course, daughters who would have been married off going to their own places elsewhere.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so Jesus is really talking about wedding talk here. I'm going away. I'm going to prepare a room for you, but you are my bride, and I am going to return, and you can bank on that. And there's going to come a day when we're going to have a joyous celebration, and I am going to take you to myself. This is part of the mood, the celebratory mood of the Last Supper, of the upper room discourse. So what we tend to remember is the communion part of it. This wine is my shed blood, and that's sober and somber. And generally, in fact, probably most of the time, we approach the Eucharist in a very somber, quiet mood. And I think we need to expand our way we think about that and fuse these two thoughts together, which Westerners have a very difficult time to do. They can't deal with paradox very well, but the Jewish mind has no problem with paradox at all, is that we approach the Lord's table, we approach the Eucharist with somber celebration.
Mm.
So that evoking not only the cross, but the wedding motif, celebration, at the same time, and we fuse those thoughts together. That's one of the things in recent years here has sort of jumped out at me as you look at the totality of what Jesus said during the Last Supper.
Now, I have a question, too, because the Passover Seder had long been observed in Israel since Old Testament times, and it was a very highly structured, ritualized kind of program that was followed for Passover Seders. Do you suppose that the disciples came to that upper room expecting a traditional Seder dinner? Because this was something quite different.
My instincts tell me no. Hmm. My instincts also tell me, in fact, the data would suggest here, this isn't a Seder meal.
This is
a form of a Seder meal. Mm-hmm. But if it were a true Passover meal, where are the rest of the families of the disciples? Where are the kids?
No, that's true. Yeah,
it's a family celebration. Mm-hmm. There are no women there. It's in an Essene monastery. So one might reason this is not a Seder in our traditional understanding of that. This is some form of a modified meal because some of the Seder components seem to be missing.
Well, I'm wondering, of course, you've taught us that the Essenes were on a different calendar, and if maybe that's the reason this wasn't the traditional Passover Seder, because in fact this would have been a couple days earlier than the rest of Jews were celebrating Passover, wouldn't it? Are you there, Doug? Nope, we've got a communications freeze up here. That has happened before, and I'm sure he'll bounce back.
Judge, Doug has...
We dropped the call. Oh, bummer. Let's see if see if we can get him back here.
Yep.
If we can't, we'll go to a song here and then bring him back. Just give the technology a couple minutes here to kind of... I don't think it's going to happen.
Are we back?
Oh, yep. There you are. We are back. I just lost your picture, but now I'm distracted. I forgot where I was. I hope you know where you were because it's important.
Well, we were talking about Seder.
Yeah. Oh, mm-hmm. I know what I mentioned was
came a little later. Perhaps there's lots of loose ends here as to what kind of a meal, but we have no issue with what Jesus said, and we have no issue with what it meant. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to pass along the fact that the wedding motif language is also a part of the upper room discourse.
Mm. Okay.
Are we there?
Yep, we're here. We're fine.
Okay. Then I want to flip over to John 19:15. There is a giant chess match going on during Passion Week. The religious establishment is trying to get Jesus killed because there's no question he's Messiah now that he's brought Lazarus back to life on the fourth day. And their issue with Jesus that he is Messiah, and so they want to accuse him of blasphemy, saying that he's God from God and therefore stone him. But Pilate could care less about that because in the Roman world, polytheism is just the way things are, so there's another God, no big deal. So because of the Sejanus revolt, which we've mentioned before, who tried to overthrow Emperor Tiberius, sedition is now the cause of the day that will get you killed almost instantly. So they shift their accusation from Jesus from one of blasphemy to sedition, and they take him to Pilate. Pilate's walking on eggshells. He does not have the best resume as a governor throughout the Roman world. In fact, a little time later, they're actually going to remove him from Israel because he didn't do a very good job. But the last thing that he's worried about is having emissaries from temple aristocracy go to Rome and complain about him, because then his jig may be up. So he has to try to control the crowd. He has to sort of try to control the Jewish aristocracy. And so he's trying to figure out how to do all this. And he comes up with a plan. And he says, there is this tradition amongst you Jews. Are we still online?
Yep, we're doing fine.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Where I release a prisoner every Passover. And so how I'm going to get out of this predicament I'm in, I don't want to be the one who kills Jesus and all the people who love him are going to be upset, maybe even have a revolt. I'm going to offer an option to the crowd of what kind of prisoner they want me to release this year. So in my plan here, I'm going to pick the worst possible prisoner I can think of, the most vile, ugliest person, and offer him together with Yeshua, who's seems to be the most perfect person who's ever lived. And obviously, the crowd will elect Jesus. And that gets me off the hook here with the establishment who's trying to force me to kill Jesus. And that will keep the crowds happy, the multitudes who love Jesus. Actually, that's not a bad idea. But if you're going to offer the crowds, actually the word is crowd singular, and in the translational side of life here, it means a gathering of people. You know, it doesn't mean 10,000.
Mm-hmm.
We have some language constraints here. And he chooses the wrong gathering of people to make this proposition to. It's the people who are in the courtyard of Herod's palace, where Pilate is holding forth during Passion Week. And there are 200 or 300 hand-picked cronies of the Jerusalem aristocracy, the Sanhedrin, and the Jerusalem elite families. And they've been coached to yell certain things at certain times, like, crucify him. And so Pilate offers up Barabbas, who's the worst possible person going, we'll pick that thread up in a minute here, offers it to the crowd, and they say, give us Barabbas, give us Barabbas. And then Pilate says, not Jesus. And then the crowd responds, who's been hand-coached here, crucify him, crucify him. And then we get in a final negotiation here, where basically in John 19, in verse 15, so they, this hand-picked crowd of 200 and 300, as well as the Jerusalem aristocracy who's orchestrating this mini crowd, away with him, away with him, crucify him, the him being Jesus here. And Pilate said to them, shall I crucify your king? And the chief priest answered, and here's the point that I'm getting to, we have no king but Caesar. Can you imagine the high priest and the chief priest saying, we have no king but Caesar? Where is their allegiance to Yahweh, Jehovah?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And here we see in 1915 what Pilate is looking for. The Jerusalem establishment is willing to subjugate themselves to Pilate's authority if he will kill Jesus. Pilate now has these guys under control. If he kills Jesus, they won't send an emissary to complain about Pilate's governance to Rome. And so now he's going to proceed to kill Jesus.
So that's really when it went from blasphemy to sedition.
Yep. And the backdrop for that is the whole Sejanus thing of sedition in Rome. Sedition is now to be squashed out wherever it rears its ugly head throughout the empire. All the governors know that. And so the high priest, the chief priest, and the elite families think they've got a pretty fail-safe strategy here to get Jesus killed.
Now, the Barabbas story is accomplished in very few sentences, but it's in each of the four Gospels, isn't it?
It is, and when you count up the words that are devoted to Barabbas, it's more words than are devoted to Judas Iscariot.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, so we take his name. It's really a fascinating name.
Yes, tell us about
Barabbas.
That.
Mm-hmm. It's like, where's his first name? We're used to Simon Bar Jonah. Simon Bar means son of. Ben is the Hebrew. Bar is the Aramaic. Simon, son of Jonah. Simon Bar Jonah. But we just get Barabbas here. Bar, son of. Abba, Abbas, father, son of father. Actually, there's another person who's a son of a father who's very active at this moment in time in this scene. It's Jesus. And I've often wondered, is he so well known that we don't need to mention his first name? You know, why isn't he Eliezer Barabbas?
That is an oddity. And there's a thing about names all through the Bible. In fact, we talked about some of that. For example, Nicodemus being a Greek name instead of a Hebrew name. Here's one of the leaders of Israel. This, though, I wonder if it could be like a John Doe. I mean, would that have been what there was no reason not to identify him, that the people knew his name.
Or he's such a scoundrel, he's convicted of multiple crimes, that maybe you don't even have to say his first name. He's so well known. I don't know. But names almost invariably have meaning in the text, in the passage in Scripture. And this one is simply a son of father. And I thought about that, and to my way of thinking, I think he represents the son of all the fathers. He's the perfect son of all the fathers. He's the perfect representative to represent us during Passion Week. There is this notion that the theologians use called the federal person, the federal man. And in a democratic system, in our federalist concept here in America, we elect somebody to represent us, and we'd like to think he's the best possible person to represent us. And in a similar way, in Eden, Adam was the representative man, the federal man, the best possible person to represent us. And therefore, when Adam fell, we all fell. That's the theological thought process you go through with this notion of the federal person. I personally think that Nicodemus is the federal religious person, the best possible religious person we can find in this culture. And as we know, he didn't get it when Jesus talked about being born again. And for Passion Week, I would like to nominate Barabbas here as the best possible federal man to represent us. He is us. He is there for a reason.
Now, if
he's
the worst
possible scoundrel, murderer, thief, seditionist in this culture. Mm-hmm. He has received perfect justice. He's been pronounced guilty. He's in a cell, and he's chained in that cell, and he's awaiting death by crucifixion. He is on a countdown to lose his life. And by way of contrast, as one theologian, a contemporary theologian, once observed, when the yardstick is the holiness of God, the difference between Adolf Hitler and you and I is lost in the rounding. Mm. We need to see ourselves as the equivalent of Barabbas when the yardstick is the holiness of God. And that's why I think it's important for us to identify with Barabbas in this Passion Week here. He is us. We are guilty. We have sinned. It's far worse than we think of. We often have far too high a view of ourselves and far too low of a view of God's holiness. And we have received perfect justice, we're guilty, and we deserve to die. And so as Barabbas sits in his cell, unbeknownst to him what's going on in the courtyard of Herod's palace where Pilate is holding forth, suddenly he hears the weak refrain, "Give us Barabbas! Give us Barabbas." And he thinks, oh my goodness, I don't even have 48 hours left. Now they're calling for me to die as quick as I can. I thought I had a couple of days left. I really am on the final countdown here by hours to lose my life. And then shortly thereafter, he hears, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" And of course, lacking the context that it's directed towards Jesus, he assumes it's directed towards him. He's guilty. He deserves to die. He's on a countdown to die. And he says, "My goodness, they're in a hurry to crucify me. Must be they want to get it done before Passover. I don't even have days left. I am down to hours and minutes." And as he sits in his dark, dank cell with mold and dank air, musty, rats nipping at his feet, chained by his ankles and by his arms, sitting on this little bench, he hears the rustle of the jailer come down the cell block. The rustle of the jailer's feet stops at the door to his cell. He hears a key rattle in the lock. The door opens. Then the jailer stands in the doorway and says, "Barabbas, you're free." And Barabbas says, what? "You're free. It can't be. I've received justice. I'm condemned to death. Look, Barabbas, I'm telling you, you're free." "Well, why am I free?" "Because," the jailer says, "someone has taken your place." "Well, who?" "Well, his name is Yeshua." "You're kidding me. The one they think is Messiah? Probably the most perfect man who's ever lived, the one who's healed hundreds of people, done phenomenal miracles, the one who teaches with an authority like no other? Yep, that's him. He's taken your place." "You mean they're going to crucify him?" "Yep. In fact, he's on his way to Golgotha now." You're kidding me. Hurry up. Take these shackles off. Which happens. Where are they taking him again? Golgotha. You can get there by the Via Della Rosa. Okay. I'm going to get there as fast as I can. But the crowd is particularly thick. Those are very narrow streets in Jerusalem. It takes him a while to elbow his way around the people in the crowds. And as he starts to get close to the front of the line, he's already at Golgotha. And he already sees Jesus being stretched out on the crossbeam. And he sees the nails being driven through his hand into the crossbeam. And he says to himself, that's supposed to be me. Those are supposed to be my hands. And then they nail the crossbeam to the main beam, and then they bend his knees up, and they run nails through the side of his ankles into the main vertical beam of the cross. And then with ropes, they lift the cross up, and they drop it into the hole, and the jarringness of that probably 2-foot drop into the hole tears his hands, and the blood starts to flow. And Barabbas looks at this scene and says, that's supposed to be my blood. And I have no idea what happened. Did he bow down in worship? Or did he turn his back and wave his hand and walk away in disgust? I have no idea how all of this might have affected Barabbas, that Jesus took his place. We'll find out in glory, actually.
That's powerful, powerful story. This is a story that should be told more often.
And, oh, my goodness, it's the heart and soul of much of what's going on here. Jesus took our place. That's the whole point of Calvary. But I want to hit the rewind button. Let's pretend we're still back in the VHS age and we can wind the tape backwards, okay?
Okay, sure.
I want to go back to Barabbas in his cell and the jailer opening the door and the jailer saying, Barabbas, you're free. And Barabbas says, forget it. I'm not interested. Shut the door. Lock it up. I want to stay here in this dark, dank environment where the rats are nipping at me, where it's hard to even breathe, where the smell from people who have been here before is a stench that you can hardly tolerate. Leave me alone. Shut the door. Lock it up. Throw away the key. I want nothing to do with Jesus taking my place. And as absurd as that sounds, as illogical, as stupid as that sounds, guess what? That decision is made tens of thousands of times every single day. As people hear about the offer, the free gift of eternal life that Jesus offers, and people say, no, thank you. That doesn't interest me in the least. Get out of here. I prefer to keep my life just the way it is.
Powerful stuff.
Yeah, so two things are going on at the same time. Pilate has condemned Jesus to death. Barabbas overhears things. And the next step is Jesus has to be scourged. Now, this is a Roman scourging and not a Jewish scourging. And the Romans have a couple of idioms. When they say 40 lashes, it means whip him with scourges until he's dead. So when Jesus is condemned for 39 scourges, it means scourge him until 5% of his life is left. In other words, take 95% of his life out of him. That's the intent of the scourging process, because they need to accelerate his death because Passover is imminent and the end of the day, sunset, is coming. So and for a Roman scourging, they'll take something called a flagon. It's long cords of leather to which pieces of bone fragment and metal have been woven in. And 39 scourges simply means to within an inch of his life. It may be hundreds of lashes, actually, not 39. 39 is the idiom, meaning almost until he's dead. And the purpose of this scourging is to deflesh the person being scourged. And so Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion of the Christ, didn't even come close to getting the bloodiness and the violence of this particular moment in time captured. All of Jesus' flesh has been torn off his back. Most of his muscles have likewise been mostly torn off his back. The reason that Cyrus of Cyrene has to pick up the crossbeam is Jesus no longer has control of his shoulder muscles. His back muscles have been basically removed. He's within 5% of dying. 95% of the life has already been taken out of him. And when he gets to Golgotha, he goes through the last 5% of his life and dies. But we need to really appreciate that the scourging takes most of the life out of Jesus. It's not the cross itself. It's the cross where his life gets finished.
And not all prisoners going to the cross, going to crucifixion, necessarily would have been scourged then.
Not to that extent, because there are records of people being alive on the cross for 3 and 4 days. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is all meant to accelerate his death. This is gruesome. And that really gives, I think, added meaning and understanding and added awesomeness as well to the phrase, by his stripes we are healed.
Indeed. Now, you mentioned 39 and 40 and that there was a Hebrew version of this. I suppose they would have actually counted, wouldn't they?
Exactly. And on the Jewish scourging, the flagrum, there are three leather strips, so it really only means 13 lashes across the back, because 13 times 3 is 39, and that's the limit for a Jewish scourging.
And that's what Paul would have undergone then.
Yeah, and we have to sort out, was it a Roman scourging or a Jewish scourging that he received? But a Jewish scourging is more going to give you wounds and scars. A Roman scourging is, you know, basically meant to kill you.
Mm. That's an amazing story, and in Barabbas, this notion that he was the son of any father, that his identity was kind of generalized by his name, and when we see it in that light, the story is just awesome.
And we should have been the one who went to that cross. Mm. That's why I think it's really important for us to identify with Barabbas. For me, he's the son of all the fathers. Mm-hmm. He's the perfect representative man to stand for us during Passion Week. When we see Barabbas, we see ourselves.
David Allen Punt, there's your one-act play, your one-man play. There it is.
That is one of the most compelling stories. And I've heard that... And it might have been from you, Doug, but about Barabbas's name, that it stands for so much more than just the name of a guy. That would be a powerful story.
Yeah, somebody needs to be doing that story in public. You know, that's got to be a YouTube. It's got to be a full length movie, perhaps. I don't know, but that has to be shouted loudly.
One of the things that just crossed my mind, Doug, is that the material like that, and I don't know how many times I've heard from producers and writers and directors and actors and all kinds of things about the dearth of good story writing, the dearth of good solid characters, and are we the only ones that have discovered Barabbas? Why aren't these stories done?
Well, I created the story that you heard about the cell and overhearing the crowd and the jailer. I mean, that's not in Scripture.
It's an illustration, yes.
That's what I would like to call appropriate imagination brought to bring the text alive so that we can see the real meaning of Barabbas, who he is, what he stands for, and what it means to us. And so... if you've ever heard me do Levi in the first person, I assemble all of the contextual facts. I see the picture for as it was originally displayed, and then I can bring appropriate imagination to that and make that story come alive. I think, to answer your question, the reason we don't have appropriately imaginative stories about what's going on in the Scriptures is because we don't see most of the context, and therefore we see it as a one-dimensional story, not a panoramic three-dimensional story, and it's much harder to get some substance out of a one-dimensional picture of something and make it into a three-dimensional story. Context always matters. It always has. It always will. And I think it's the key to really bringing much of these Bible passages alive in fresh and new ways for our culture without compromising the original meaning, so that we can be stunned and stirred and soothed anew in these days.
And Doug, that's what makes your time with us so valuable to all of us, and the Ministry of Preserving Bible Times so valuable. I want to suggest that folks visit the website. It's a brand new, beautiful website, preservingbibletimes.org. And you can link there from our website at brokenroadradio.com and explore the resources that Preserving Bible Times has for you, your small groups, your Bible studies, your church. It's an invaluable resource. And one of my passions now is helping Doug here through Broken Road Radio to bring this contextual story to light, because it really does make, I think of those greeting cards that those old folded and hand-cut greeting cards. You open them up and a three-dimensional scene just pops up. That's what happens when you open your Bible once you have a handle on that context. It is so important and so fundamental to a proper understanding, a full understanding of what's there. So, Doug, as always, thank you so much. We wish you the best in Dallas and a safe journey home, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, guys, and for you and your listeners, may you all have an anointed Easter.
And to you too, Doug. Thank you so
much. You too, Doug.
Yeah. Thanks.
Music continues now on a Broken Road Radio Wednesday morning from Les Baxter and his orchestra.